Security. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 043156 and 3537, Brandeis Machinery and Supply Company against the National Labor Relations Board and the International Union of Operating Engineers. Mr. Sales.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Brandeis Machinery and Supply Company, a heavy equipment and mining equipment distributor with facilities throughout Kentucky and Indiana. The locus of the dispute before you today was in South Bend, Indiana, where Brandeis Machinery had started up a branch hoping to expand its business shortly after September of 2001. Sadly, at that time, the economy, for obvious reasons, deteriorated, and this business was a rough start from the very beginning. The issue before you today deals with a union organizing drive that was commenced by two employees of Brandeis who were hired based upon a false representations that they made on their application and about their credentials and skills. They had the right, apparently, to do that. We're not gainsaying or attempting to second-guess that, at least not here. I suppose that would be for the legislature. But the point is that that did occur. When they were hired in the late winter and early spring of 2002, they did not make any effort, at least ostensibly, to organize until May 1 of 2002, when they began soliciting individual employees of Brandeis during lunches or whatnot at that particular time during breaks to inquire as to their interest in joining a union.
The first and you're referring to Cook and Morosky?
Well, Cook and Benfield were the two internal union organizers, Your Honor.
And you're not contesting that Cook, at least, in terms of the hiring decision, he was asked about his union affiliation.
We are not contesting that part of the charge. We disagreed with the conclusions, but at this level, we realize that the substantial evidence of a rule applies, and we can't overcome that, and that's why we did not appeal that, Your Honor.
All right.
In May, when they began soliciting employees, they were immediately rejected by two or three employees. This was a very small facility. So by May 2 or May 3, after they had actually talked with a couple of employees and been rebuffed, the union organizing drive, for all intent and purposes, was stillborn, although at this point management didn't know about it until Friday, May 3, when a letter was received by Sam Freeman, the plant manager, announcing the union organizing drive and also announcing Mr. Benfield and Mr. Cook as the in-house organizer.
How many employees were on the rolls during this period at the South Bend facility?
It varied, but I think at that time somewhere between 8 or 9 employees, Your Honor.
I see.
There was a couple of sales representatives that flowed in and out, but I'm not sure they would have ever been included in a bargaining unit if we had ever gotten to that point. What happened thereafter was on May 6, Mr. Freeman Amundi was not in because he was ill. May 7, when he came in, things started to happen which give rise to the facts and the context of this case. The facts that started on May 7 and then continued on through the end of May, resulting in the termination of Mr. Benfield, were the subject of unfair labor practice charges. About 17 allegations were of separate violations of the act were alleged. A trial was held before an administrative law judge. Roughly half of those allegations were dismissed, including, from our purposes, perhaps the most serious ones relating to discriminatory discharge, discriminatory discipline, work assignments, and overtime opportunity discrimination. But there were several that were still remaining that violations were found. We're here today on six of them. They are our principal objection, or our principal disagreement with the board's analysis of this issue and the ALJ's, is that the board and the ALJ did not apply the expertise which Congress and this court, or in all the courts, have expected the NLRB to apply. They were on these issues before you, it was basically on autopilot. There was no context that the board recognized or the ALJ recognized when he had judged Brandeis guilty of the unfair labor practices that are before you.
When you say the issues that are before us, though, the charge that you're not appealing, that sort of permeates everything here, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know that
if you want to look at whether there's anti-union animus, and you see what happened right in the at the beginning here, and then you can kind of bleed that into the lunchroom thing and the hat and all these other.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because what happened, the charges that were not appealing, because we are, they basically occurred in November, December, January, February, when Mr. Cook was hired, and then later in February when Mr. Benfield was hired. Those facts, that was over and done with. Whatever you would believe or whatever the board found about them, they found us guilty of some unfair labor practices in the interrogation and discussions about this being a non-union shop.
So but what I'm getting at here is you would like us to put that aside and not consider any of those actions as they might relate to or give context to the other violations that were found.
No, I would not say that. I would say you must put them in the context, Your Honor, as you must put into the context all the other things which the board, frankly, did not consider and paid no attention to whatsoever. For example, in the speech that Mr. Snowden gave on May 8, coupled with the policy manual, which has the admonition about coercion and threats, in both of those situations, you have a context that was ignored by the board. For example, with respect to the speech that the policy manual, the written policy says that the company will help stop interference or coercion, but only after it has said the union has a right to, you have a right to join a union, you have a right not to join a union. If anybody interferes or coerces you into trying to sign a union card, what will the company do? We'll do what we can within the limits of the law. That's in the policy. That is about as innocuous as it could possibly get. The fact of the matter is that there is nothing about that policy which should have been raised any particular alarm. What the board did was basically ignore the Liberty Nursing Home balancing text because they didn't at all address the context, and instead basically took almost a per se approach to the problem. The fact is that in another case that for the D.C. Circuit, the AdTrans case, which is cited in all of our briefs, I believe, the D.C. Circuit found a statement by a company that if you are threatened, to be sufficiently specific as to be protected in permissible conduct under the NLRA in the midst of other unfair labor practices that had been found there. I would suggest that where a company that says you have a right to join a union or not, and that if there's interference with what? That right to join or not join a union, or coercion with what? That right to join or not join a union. That's what they're referring to. Then we'll do what? What we can to stop harassment within the letter of the law. I don't know how they could have had a policy that would have been other than not having one, which I think is where the board is headed. that would be so inoffensive. The same is true with Gene Snowden's speech on May 8th. He came in, he told the employees that they have a right to join a union. They have, he said, the union folks have a right to talk to you. He even went on to say they have a right to follow you onto your property. You have a right not to talk to them. You have a right to remove them from your property. And if they get so aggressive that you feel harassed, we'll do what we can within our legal means to prevent harassment. That is the context, and that, again, is innocuous. There's nothing about that statement or which should have raised any alarm. What the board did, ignored the context of what came before, we'll do what we can, report it, and we'll do what we can. Ignored the context of that in fact had happened, that employees were followed home, that employees were told that when they were followed home that the union has a right to follow them home, but they don't have to invite them on their property. They can insist that they leave. Your Honor, this is about I think that's the context we think is most important, because that's the context that is most temporal and far removed from the statements that we are conceding to that occurred several months earlier. I'd also point out, Your Honor, that at the once the union organizing drive became known, and this was clear in the record, Mr. Freeman, his authority was severely circumscribed. Why? Because the company wanted to be very careful, and there was so a lot of what happened after the company found out about it was clearly directed from the senior management of the company in Louisville. The same analysis applies to Tom Muraski's statements to Benfield, asking him to stop soliciting about for the union during working time. Why? They had almost had fights immediately preceding Muraski's statement. There had been fights, or near fights, excuse me. He had a confrontation with Karen Bailey. He had a confrontation with Ken Lubinsky, a confrontation with Kevin Hardy. Tom Muraski described overhearing one saying it sounded like a manager and an umpire going at it in a baseball game. Well, that's good theater in a baseball game, but it's pretty dangerous on a plant floor. And it's something a company has a right to prevent, and a company has a right to use discipline to take care of. What did the company do in this case?
Well, couldn't the company have just told those employees that were involved in the argument that that argument was inappropriate, they needed to control their temper?
They did do that with Ms. Bailey. As a matter of fact, she was reprimanded and told that if she used the vulgarities which had mm-hmm. attended her part of the argument, that she could be fired.
Why couldn't that be done to all the employees that were involved in the...
It could have been, Your Honor, but I think the issue that we're raised right now is that we believe that what the company did do was appropriate under the circumstances and in context was not offensive. The two issues with respect to, but it was that context that we believe the board ignored. They didn't apply the balancing test. And therefore, we don't think that those charges can be sustained. With respect to the...
But of course, if we agree with you, then the board should have just totally ignored the major violations that happened before all this occurred.
No, I don't...
Because you keep talking about context. Certainly the board was entitled to look at those violations and put that in context. I understand you're saying that they didn't put all the specifics of those later events in context, but certainly they couldn't ignore that, could they?
No, I don't think they could ignore that, Your Honor, but the fact is that those, given the time lag between those events and given the fact that at the time that Mr. Snowden gave his speech, that Tom Muraski gave his warning, that later on, Mr. Freeman, who was really out of the picture in terms of decision making, that was also part of the context, which was in fact ignored. Mr. Freeman was taken out of the decision making because they thought he had a heart attack. I guess the stress of the situation got to him and put him in the hospital the weekend after he found out about the union organizing drive. I don't know exactly. I don't know if we'll ever know, but And the company wanted to take the pressure off of him, and that was clearly done, and that was a part of the context also, which was, in fact, ignored. With respect to the two issues, or there's three issues remaining, I suppose I'll have to deal with one of them in rebuttal, but with the removal of the hat and the button, this was I'm really stunned that these issues are still here. The fact of the matter is that a manager says you'd look better with this hat rather than the hat you have. Well, my gosh, the manager has the right to tell the guy, I wish you wouldn't vote for the union. I think you ought to vote for the company. A manager has a right to do that. This hat business was just simply another way of saying the same thing. They're trying to restrict my client's rights to engage in basically its own protected speech. Same as with the button. Freeman didn't order him to take the button off. He just said, take it off the logo. Don't obliterate the logo on our uniform, which we provide to you. About as innocuous as it gets.
So there was a uniform requirement at Brandeis?
They had a uniform. I don't know if it was a requirement or if it was just available to them, but they had a uniform with a logo on it, and if they're going to use the logo, Freeman did not want the logo obliterated.
Yeah, but there was no uniform requirement.
I'm not certain that the record established that there was a requirement or not. I think I don't know if it was optional or required.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear now from Mr. Laurel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Greg Laurel, counsel for the National Labor Relations Board. Your Honor, I'm here to ask you today to grant full enforcement to the Board's order. And I'd like to briefly lay out a couple points at the outset. One, as the petitioner admits, they concede that they violated the Act by interrogating employees regarding their union affiliation and threatening them with plant closure. Now, not only are these serious violations, but as you've noted, they provide the context for the other violations. Secondly, one thing I want to say at the outset is the test for whether Section 8A1 is violated is clearly whether the company's conduct has a tendency to coerce. I point this out because in its brief, the company frequently says, we didn't actually coerce, we didn't actually reprimand our employees, we didn't actually deter them from exercising their rights, but that's not the test. And one other thing I would point out is that the company points out that this union campaign was stillborn. However, the fact that the company thinks that does not take away the employee's right to keep trying and to keep attempting to organize. And the company also points out that the board did not apply its expertise here, didn't look at context, address things in a vacuum. That's simply not true. The opinion is very detailed and has a rich analysis of all the relevant facts. Now, with this in mind, I think, first of all, it's clear that the company did violate the Act when it implied that Mr. Cook should remove his union hat in favor of a company hat. This was more than just a comment. This was the company's supervisor taking the physical act of stepping up to the employee and suggesting, I think you should wear this company hat instead. And this wasn't the first time comments had been made about union insignia. This act has to be seen in light of the fact that just a few days earlier, another supervisor told Mr. Cook that he did not appreciate him wearing that hat. And it also has to be seen in light of the uncontested violations. It is Mr. Cook, we must recall, who was unlawfully interrogated in the beginning. Now, in light of all these facts and consistent with well-settled precedent, the board properly found that this was a violation.
What about counsel's argument that there was a time lapse? There was such a time lapse between when those violations occurred and these other incidents that should have had a low priority in terms of the board's review or evaluation of the charges?
Well, I think the question is, how would a reasonable employee view it? And I think Mr. Cook would still have in his mind the fact that he had been interrogated about his union affiliations, and he may very well know that at least one other employee had been threatened with plant closure. In addition, you look at all the other facts we have here, the multiple comments on wearing a hat and the whole context. I think there's more than substantial evidence to support a violation. And I think there's also more than substantial evidence to support the finding that the company violated the Act by asking its employers to report harassment by the union. The company unlawfully encouraged its employees to report unprotected activity. And what's striking is that what happened here is very similar to other violations that this court has found, in that, first of all, the company makes an extremely vague, subjective request. The president no less, asked all of his employees to report whenever they feel harassed, a request that's so vague it tends to include protected activity. And what's important here is the context. This speech was made in response to union activity, it was linked to union activity, and it targeted union activity.
Well, what type of language should Brandeis have employed in his speech and in the written policies that would not violate the act, that would inform the employees of their rights to either talk or not to talk to the union?
Well, first of all, the fact that the company had generally applicable neutral policies on reporting harassments and threats shows that they didn't have to take this extra step of targeting union activity in such a vague manner. I feel that what they did here falls far short of any reasonable standard. To ask them to report feeling harassed, to target union activity in particular, I don't think being reasonably specific isn't particularly onerous standard. The company could avoid that kind of extremely subjective language. They could make some attempt to give examples of activity that should be reported.
So what specific language do you have or do you think they should have used?
Well, I think they could have stood on their generally applicable policies. And they could have said, there have been some incidents, as you know, and I'm going to remind you today, we have a policy against harassment, we have a policy against violence as well, we have a policy against threats, and anyone who violates that policy will be dealt with. The company doesn't explain why they have a right or why they needed to have this kind of subjective language, asking employees to report feeling harassed, which clearly encourages them to report whenever they subjectively feel harassed by protected activity. And I don't think that the company's response that it's reasonably specific, as they put it, just because they note that you can talk to a union is very helpful when the last thing the employees will remember is the president asking them to report feeling harassed. I also think, you know, that the cases the company cites are just other examples of similar requests about reporting harassment being found unlawful. But if I may, Your Honor, we have a couple other violations here that are really quite straightforward. For one thing,
are you talking about that lunchroom thing?
Yes, sir.
Seems pretty thin to me that a small company like this can't decide to stagger their lunch periods.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the impact is thin here. What happened was the company realized that its employees were engaging their rights during lunchtime, and it then staggered lunchtime to prevent any employees from sharing lunch, to prevent them from talking about the union during lunch. And I think here there is extremely strong evidence of anti-union animus. We have it in the timing. Just days after learning of these lunchtime union activities, the company suddenly staggers all lunches and shortens the lunch period from an hour to a half hour. What's also striking is the overbreadth of what they did. If they truly just needed to make sure that they had a mechanic available, which I think is their claim, they could have just staggered the lunches of mechanics. Instead, they staggered the lunches of all employees, mechanics or not. And I think given that context, the board had more than ample evidence to find a Section 8A3 violation.
But you talk about timing, though. When was the problem with the non-availability of a mechanic on the floor in relation to the change in policy?
I believe the one incident that I think caused a 5-minute delay in one customer service repair occurred the day before the policy was changed.
Yeah. So, I mean, the timing can work both ways.
The timing could work both ways, but it was certainly reasonable for the board to find in this case that it showed anti-union animus and that it showed a violation, especially in light of the overbreadth of what the company did. If we want to take the company's word at it, that they just wanted to make sure their mechanics are available, then they should have just made sure their mechanics are available. They didn't need to stagger the lunch of all employees. And another thing they didn't need to do was prohibit all of their employees from talking about the union. The company admits they did that here. They prohibited employees from talking about the union. They did not prohibit employees from talking about any other non-work subject during working time. And this clearly constitutes a violation of the act. There's also no evidence that doing so was necessary to preserving the peace, as the company puts it. Rather, if the company truly just wanted to keep the peace, as Your Honors have noted, they could have simply barred fighting, swearing, or any other conduct they actually found disruptive. And I think, you know, also when you look at, again, the timing of barring union activity, it's right after the company's becoming aware of this activity, and again, it suggests more anti-union animus, even though that's not necessary to a Section 8A1 claim. So I think, Your Honors, across the board, the order is supported by substantial evidence and should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lauro. We'll hear now from Ms. LaRose.
May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth LaRose, and I represent Local 150 of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Intervenor. Your Honors, as the Board's decision indicates, Brandeis engaged in a course of conduct here that was designed to suppress discussion about the union and employee congregation to discuss the union. The Board very properly affirmed the ALJ's determination that Brandeis violated Section 8A1 when it issued written and oral policies designed to encourage employees to report one another for union activity. Pursuant to board law in cases such as Colony Printing from this court, it is unlawful for an employer to utilize subjective terms that catch in their sweep peaceful protected activity, such as a peaceful solicitation to sign a union card. Brandeis suggests that a contextual analysis is appropriate, and if it is, Your Honors, its policies fail even under those tests, including the ones articulated by this court in Bloomington Normal. Of note, Your Honors, Mr. Freeman, the branch manager, testified that at least one of the union organizers never threatened him nor anyone else, as far as he knew. One of the employees who was approached with a union solicitation, Mike Kerr, indicated that he had never felt threatened by the union organizers.
You mentioned that Colony Printing case, but don't we have a little different situation here, because there we were concerned that there was a letter saying that employees should report persons who, quote, put you under any kind of pressure, end quote, and didn't really distinguish between coercive conduct and lawful organizing activity. Here, the policy only applies to unlawful organizing activity. So can you really rely on Colony?
Your Honor, I think to the average employee, the terms pressure, harassment, coercion, interference, feel harassed are no different. They're as ambiguous to them as the terms that were used in Colony Printing. So I think that case is comparable. Additionally, Your Honors, Brandeis submits that a balancing test is appropriate to determine whether its policies are lawful. And the union submits that under existing law, there is no support for the application of a balancing test. Furthermore, the union submits that the board correctly determined that Brandeis violated the act when, through Supervisor Moraski, it discriminatorily and solely prohibited discussion about the union. As this court knows, an employer cannot prohibit discussions about union solicitation while permitting other non-work subjects to be discussed in the workplace. In this case, the rule was facially discriminatory. Supervisor Moraski indicated that he was only forbidding discussions about, quote, union stuff, unquote. The policy manual and Moraski's own testimony indicate that Brandeis routinely tolerated discussions about non-work subjects in the workplace. There was no limitation on what employees could discuss except for the union. Brandeis does not submit substantial proof that it needed this rule in order to maintain production or discipline for the reasons so eloquently stated by the general counsel. Furthermore, its rule was unlawfully ambiguous in that there was an exchange between Benefield and Moraski about what the parameters of the rule were, and there were terms used that the board and this court have previously found to be unlawful, that is, that there should not be discussions about the union during working hours or on the clock. Furthermore, Your Honors, the union submits that the board correctly found that the company violated 8A3 by staggering lunch hours and shortening lunch time for employees in response to employee union solicitations at lunchtime. Excuse me, Your Honors. Pursuant to Rightline and other cases, the employer bears the burden of persuasion in order to demonstrate that it would have taken the action, the protested action, regardless of union activity. In this case, the board found the employer's explanation to be unpersuasive. In that, the employer applied its lunchtime policy to all the employees instead of the ones that were simply implicated by the problem of supposedly being unable to attend to a repair quickly. Additionally, the board very correctly noted that the problem was one time and it only lasted 5 minutes. For these reasons, Your Honors, I believe that the board very correctly found that Brandeis had not sustained its burden with respect to this 8A3 violation. Your Honor, there was an indication in Brandeis's oral argument that it felt that somehow its statement in regard to Muraski's hat was protected pursuant to 8C. We would submit that that expression was not protected by 8C because it was not an expression of a preference in favor of or against a union. It was simply an exchange over a hat or a button, as the case may be. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honors. I would submit that because the board's decision has a reasonable basis in law and is supported by the substantial evidence, this court should uphold the board's decision in its totality. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. LaRose. Sir, your time had expired. You had used all your rebuttal time, but I'll be glad to give you a moment if you like. You could have 1 minute if you like in case you have something important that needs to be put on the table.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the context of this case, the fact is that the question of whether someone's feeling harassed, whether someone is coerced, someone is interfered with in their rights, is no different, no more subjective or ambiguous than when one is threatened. That was the holding in AdTrans. Finally, with respect to the lunchtime staggering, Your Honor, the evidence in this case was by Steve Benfield at 183 of the transcript that when he was told about this change in the lunch hours, he was told they were to be staggered in 1/2 hour because the other branches do it and because they wanted men or women in the shop at all times. There was no evidence that it was done for any other reason, and the evidence was absent on that issue other than what Benfield's statement of what he was told and Shuck's testimony of why he did it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, the court thanks Mr. Sales, Mr. Laurel, and Mr. Rose for their fine presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.